The Education Gadfly Show starts now. Hello, this is your host, Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, here with my indomitable co-host, the Andre Agassi of Education Policy. He's kissing the crowd as we speak, Rick Hess. Welcome, Rick.
The whole thesaurus got rolled out this week, didn't it, babe?
Nice. Rick, you know, you would look good like Andre does with a shaved head.
I like that. I like that.
Have you ever considered that?
I have not. You know, I thought Andre actually looked a lot better when he had the curly locks back in the 80s. He was a good-looking man.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you've got good hair, so, you know, you're lucky that way.
I appreciate
it. Some of us have to get ready for the Andre Agassi look, which is inevitable someday.
Yeah, but you're a good-looking man. You're good-looking regardless.
Oh, well, thank you, Rick. Well, some very bad news over the holiday weekend. As I'm sure our listeners know, Steve Irwin, otherwise known as the Crocodile Hunter, was savagely attacked by a large stingray off the Australian coast. He did not survive the encounter. Rick, what are we to make of this?
Well, he did not survive the encounter. When you get killed by a stingray, you rarely survive the encounter. I think it's a real blow to education.
Yes. Look, I mean, seriously, the guy inspired a lot of children, you know, to learn more about science. I know my own nephews and nieces were big fans of the Crocodile Hunter. This is a sad day.
Isn't he the one who left his, like, 8-month-old kid in a pen with a couple of crocodiles?
I'm checking with our producer, Jen. Was that really him? Boy, you know, the poor man just died and you have to knock his reputation.
Well, I'm just saying. You kind of invite these things when you behave irresponsibly.
All right. Well, listeners.
It's like the guy, there was a van accident in D.C. this weekend. A guy got thrown. They were trying to run away from a cop because they had drugs in the van.
Yeah.
And the guy got thrown through the window and both his feet got severed.
Yeah. So,
and I feel bad for him, but at the same time, when you're trying to run away from cops because you're throwing drugs out the window, these things are going to happen.
I can't believe you're equating the Crocodile Hunter with some drug runner.
It wasn't really a runner. He's just driving a van.
All right. Well, that's Rick Zero Tolerance Hess. We're going to talk about that issue and some other things later in the show. If you have any thoughts about whether or not the Crocodile Hunter was an excellent teacher, send us a letter at letters@edexcellence.net. Okay, shall we get going, Rick?
Let's do it.
All right, we're going to start with the game of Pardon the Gadfly. Then we've got a dandy of an interview this week. And then we will hear from our weird correspondent, Liam, with some very snooze blah weird of the...
Well, that was nicely done, Mike. Thank you. Okay. Let's roll, baby.
Keep going. Okay, we're going to keep going. We're going to keep going. That's right, because you know what? Here in the podcast, we just keep going.
It's nearly live radio.
That's what we do, nearly live. Okay, are we ready? Topic number one, Malcolm Gladwell, one of your favorite authors, I understand, the New York writer who pens books about blinking and tipping and won the 1995 National Magazine Award, has entered the education fray in the September 4th New Yorker. He takes zero tolerance policies to task and argues, in effect, that teachers and administrators should have more wiggle room when disciplining students. What do you think, Rick? A nuanced approach or soft on crime?
I mean, it makes a certain degree of sense, right? Let's go back to our guy who got his feet severed when thrown out of his van, right? I mean, that's a little bit of punishment already embedded in, you know, in the crime. I don't know how much time the guy still needs to do. Look, of course, principals and teachers, you know, in a perfect world, are going to have some flexibility when meting out punishment. They know the kids. They've got a school culture they've got a sense of. They know what a discretion means in context. So you want them to have – you want them ability to make judgment. The bigger point here is that Malcolm Gladwell himself – I mean, he won his National Magazine Award for a profile of a guy who sells rotisserie on late-night TV. His books are basically clever collections of anecdote that leave me, for one, vaguely unconvinced. I'm not sure that he's necessarily the guy we want to be taking direction from when it comes to school discipline policy.
So, Rick, it sounds like you have zero tolerance for authors that actually make a lot of money off their books.
That's a book I would buy from that cat, man. If he wrote a book, Money Making, I would be all over that thing.
Very nice. But, you know, look, Rick, I actually think that the zero tolerance policies, you know, I go back and forth, but I can see their value. I mean, it depends on what level you're talking about, you know. I mean, statewide policies may be too much, but in terms of certainly a school-wide policy or district-wide policy that makes it very clear that if there's any kind of violence, any kind of bullying or harassment, that there's going to be a serious, you know, serious punishment. I think that makes perfect sense.
Wow, oof. You fit that in nicely, Beth.
Wow. Zero tolerance for us.
Okay.
Thanks to our producer, Jen. Okay.
There you go.
You know, it's Jen's birthday today.
I'd heard rumors to that effect.
That's right. She's got a big smile on. Yeah. Looks like we'll have to maybe sing her happy birthday later on.
Oh, it's a beautiful gesture.
Okay.
Although by the time this airs, or by the time it's posted on the web,
yeah,
no longer so much.
Well, that's true. Because, you know, time is slipping through our fingers.
One day at a time.
Okay. What's the second topic?
It's not Valerie Bertinelli, though it might be. Topic two. Last Sunday, Jay Matthews had a front page article in the Washington Post all about national standards, Mike. Is Fordham Foundation's hobby horse catching on? Is it a wave cresting across the nation?
Wow, two mixed metaphors. I like that. I do think our hobby horse is catching on. We're going to ride that hobby horse all the way off into the sunset. This is a big, good week for us. You know, last week here on the podcast, we found out that God was in favor of national testing. Thanks to Prophetess Virginia, who gave us that news. Very exciting. And I have to think that he had a role to play. Front page, above the fold, lead story. It's Sunday, Washington Post, story about national testing. Not too bad.
Well, now, the story wasn't really about national testing, right? It was about the incoherence and silliness of the accountability system that we jury-rigged together under No Child Left Behind. Now, one strategy, if you're, you know, ardent federalizers, ardent nationalizers like the Fordham team, one way to interpret this is it gives us an excuse to put that much more power into the hands of petty federal bureaucrats.
A
second strategy here, though, is to say, look, this is an explanation why reasonable folks might be dubious about federal involvement in setting educational accountability and standards at all. Isn't that a problem?
No, but see, what's the point here, Rick? What would you do? What's the alternative? You're going to go back and try to get the federal government out of education altogether? That's not going to happen. So, you know, you and some of these other people can say, oh, you know, we're so upset that the federal government's involved. We need to find a new deal, a new deal, a new federalism that calls for the federal government to play a limited role in terms of setting the expectations, making sure that there is real accountability in the system, and then getting out of the day-to-day affairs. That is a grand bargain.
Wow, you just endorsed both Roosevelt and Nixon.
How about
the
that?
Same sentence. That's a hell of an accomplishment.
Look, that's the bipartisan Thomas B. Fordham Foundation for you.
Okay.
All right. Our final topic, Rick, and I have to say, you're looking a little sleepy, so this one makes some sense. The Wall Street Journal's Stephen Moore, not known as a left-winger by any means, he thinks he knows how to improve education. Let kids sleep. His children attend public schools outside Washington in Fairfax, Virginia, and he's aghast at how early classroom doors open. Student achievement will rise, he writes, once we stop making zombies take high-stakes tests. Rick, is he right? More sleep for the teenagers?
More in favor of more. I like that. I mean, the interesting thing here is usually the people who complain about school start times are lefties. So it's kind of funny to see the Wall Street Journal editorial page getting engaged in this.
Wait, what is it? That conservatives sleep, are early to bed,
usually,
early to rise?
Yeah, no excuses. Usually the whole sleep thing is, oh, people want to apologize for children. But now, suddenly, the right has discovered the right to sleep. I think that's interesting. I mean, the real problem here is there's a fair bit of research which says you start school too early, it creates some problems. The other side, though, is that we're not crazy about school districts spending money on non-peripheral things, things that happen that have no relation to learning. Among those are school buses and buying new transport.
Ah, yes.
In order to get efficient use of school buses, you got to triple shift them. You got to run your little kids, your middle school kids, and your high school kids. Well, that means that unless you want to have the elementary school kids, say, getting home at 4:30 or 5 o'clock in the evening, that you wind up having to start the whole shebang early enough in the day that you can have a full school day and get the kids home at an hour that makes the parents happy.
All right, but I never did understand, though, why they didn't have the little kids go to school first thing in the morning when they're already up and awake. I mean, anybody who's been around little kids knows that they wake up at, you know, 5:30, 6 a.m. Anyway, but you know what? You're absolutely right about the busing situation. And, you know, haven't we gotten to the point where maybe the school bus is just, you know, passe?
I'm with you, baby. Virtual schooling is
very
Well,
there's
very,
virtual schooling. I mean, you know, there's option. Walking to work. There's biking to work. And then, you know, there's also having parents drive the kids to work.
It kind of restricts choice, doesn't it?
Well, it, you know, I don't know if it restricts choice. I mean, I don't know. You know, use public transportation if you need it. But, you know, do we really need every school district in the country to have its own fleet of buses?
You raise a good question.
I do raise a good question, don't I? And I'd be curious what people think. Well, that is all we've got time for Pardon the Gadfly. Now we turn to our interview, as I said before, a great one this week. Let's take a listen. We're here today with Dr. Hillel Fradkin, who is an Islamic scholar at the Hudson Institute here in Washington, D.C. Dr. Frotkin has studied and written a lot about how schools should teach about the 9/11 attacks. We want to talk to him about that issue today as we get ready to mark the anniversary of that horrific event. Dr. Frotkin, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much, Mr. Petrilli.
We've been able to take a look at some of the brand new U.S. history and world history textbooks that have come out. We've been taking a look at how they handle teaching about 9/11. Some of them, you know, seem to be pretty decent, you know, at least as far as textbooks go, but there are some real concerns. It seems to us, and from what we understand from your perspective, that it's important, of course, to provide students with enough context to understand these terrorist attacks. One thing is to really understand at least enough about Islam and the way that Al-Qaeda has twisted Islam to make sense of what happened on 9/11. Yet when we look at these books, for example, there's no mention of the word jihad. Tell us a little bit about that. Why? How do you think schools need to go about giving students the context they need to understand that part of this story?
Well, you know, we had a specific event on 9/11, a terrible event, and it took several thousand American lives. But it was, of course, it wasn't prepared the day before. It was prepared years before, actually. It took 2 years to plan this attack. And it followed a whole series of attacks. So it is with a kind of culminating attack on the United States. And one has to appreciate in particular that there was a group out there that was trying to attack us for over a long period of time. And by the way, it said it was going to try to, but several years before the attack. So one needs to appreciate that fact and then try to understand what why they were doing that and what, of course, it might portend for the future.
You know, and the textbooks seem to try to dance around the issue of religion, perhaps understandably so, but, you know, how should they address this? How do they need to discuss the ideas of jihad that Osama bin Laden would have? Tell us a little bit about that.
Well, I think it's perfectly fine to make clear that Al-Qaeda, Osama bin Laden, does not represent all Muslims. That is to say, not all people, all Muslims subscribe to his views, let alone are, you know, members of his organization, nor would they be active in any terrorist act. But it is important, I think, to understand that bin Laden and others like him do raise a claim that they are acting on behalf of Islam. In fact, on behalf of the truest, purest understanding of Islam. That's a disputable claim, but it's a significant claim and one which has to be appreciated. Hence, it's really quite hard to simply to ignore the fact that a religious claim is being made here.
Okay. Well, let me read you a passage from one of the textbooks that we were able to get a hold of. This is Glencoe World History. They actually cover all of 9/11 on one page. And on that page, there's a sidebar. It says, why it matters. Let me read you a little bit from that sidebar. It says, the destruction of the World Trade Center was not an attack on the United States alone. People from over 80 countries were killed in what the United Nations condemned as a, quote, crime against humanity. More and more, people are coming to understand that destructive forces unleashed in one part of the world soon affect the entire world. Terrorism, worldwide hunger, nuclear proliferation, global warming, these issues make us aware of the global nature of contemporary problems. Increasingly, the world's nations must unite to create lasting solutions. So, Professor Frotkin, do you think this is the key message we're supposed to take out of the 9/11 attacks? What do you think about this?
Hardly. it's an attempt to obviously deflect the question of the attack itself into a whole bunch of other political concerns, which may or may not be legitimate, but have nothing directly to do with 9/11 and nothing directly to do with the kind of threat that Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups present. Al-Qaeda didn't attack us because of global warming or nuclear proliferation, unless it's unless on the grounds that we wouldn't let them have a bomb. This is really not helpful for understanding what the situation is. But furthermore, I mean, it is quite true that the citizens or natives of 80 different countries died at the World Trade Center. That's not a reflection of Al-Qaeda's trying to draw in the entire world. It's a rather reflection of the fact that the United States is a country of immigrants and welcomes and embraces people from all over the world. And that is to say, Bin Laden was trying to attack the United States, and not the 80 nations from which these people came. He was trying to attack it because of a very specific characteristic of the United States. The United States is, by his understanding and our own, the leader of what used to be called the free world. We are the world's largest and most successful, or we are the longest lived and most successful liberal democracy, and that's what Bin Laden and other people like him have against us.
Well, unfortunately, students who use the Glencoe World History textbook in their courses aren't going to be getting that message when they study about this attack. Well, Dr. Fradkin, thank you so much.
If I may say one further thing about this, this is not an interpretation of things on my part. This is what people like Bin Laden, like Zarqawi, like the president of Iran say about their hostility to us, that it has to do with what the system of governance we have.
Absolutely. And, you know, even a reading of the 9/11 report would tell you as much. And unfortunately, some of these textbooks, just for some reason, don't want to report all the facts about this attack. Okay. Well, Dr. Fradkin, thanks again.
Well, I would say, I suppose, I guess one can understand to some degree there's a kind of generous side to it, which amounts to saying that people are reluctant to say things which might inspire hatred of Muslims, but this is not a solution to that problem.
That's right. That's right. Okay. Well, thanks so much for coming on the show, and I hope you'll consider joining us again.
I would happily do so.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much. Well, Rick, what do you think? Do you agree?
Wow. That's some good stuff.
Yeah.
I'm feeling it.
Very good. Very good. All right. Well, it is time for everybody's favorite education news of the weird with our special correspondent, Liam Julian. Liam, come on, hit us with some weirdness. What you got?
Actually, Mike, this week's news of the weird was submitted by a loyal listener, Rick's very own assistant, Morgan. It seems like the superintendent of the Manning, Iowa school district is in some hot water after posing for a 2007 calendar that is being sold to raise money for charity. The superintendent, Roger Schmiedeskamp, and 11 other community men, bankers, insurance salesmen, etc., appear partially disrobed in a spoof of the 2003 movie Calendar Girls, in which 12 middle-aged women appear naked to raise money for a hospital. But some in Manning, Iowa, aren't laughing. Kathy Swanson, who has both children and grandchildren in Manning schools and probably doesn't find that the least bit odd, is apoplectic over Schmiedeskamp's photo, which shows the superintendent without a shirt, sitting behind a desk in an old school classroom with his bare legs exposed. Viewers are meant to assume Schmiedeskamp, Mr. August, is nude. Swanson said, quote, "A kid is supposed to be safe in the classroom. This does not portray safe. It's sickening."
I sure wouldn't want to sit in that chair afterwards.
And Gary Reichel, he's an area farmer, father of two Manning High School students, agrees, quote, "In my mind, that is softcore porn," he said. Rick, does AEI put out risque calendars featuring its scholars in various stages of undress? And what month would you be?
Wow, that is softcore porn. They really don't define. They got to see real porn out in Iowa. That's all I'm saying. AEI does not. If we did, I think Richard Pearl would probably already have January staked out. So I don't. I guess I'd have to, struggle with Jim Kirkpatrick to see who would be May. I think it's strange that the superintendent would be Mr. August, isn't that?
Well, it's back to school time. Come on.
It's not really. I don't think of August as a school month.
Well, it is now. It is. But the question, and Liam, maybe you didn't really report this, and in your reporting, there's an important detail left out. I know it might be uncomfortable for you, but do we have any idea whether or not the superintendent was attractive without his shirt on?
I didn't see a picture. Perhaps Morgan has one of the calendars.
Ah, okay. Well, Rick, if you could ask Morgan to let us know.
I will check in with her.
Because, if frankly, depending on how he actually looks, might explain the reaction to some of them, from some of those parents.
Apparently, the school board is behind him 100%. They've been encouraging him to get involved with the community.
Uh-huh.
And so they're pleased about this.
Excellent. Are they going to take their shirts off at the next meeting?
Didn't say.
They're okay. Getting involved.
Liam, that was pretty weird.
Yeah, thanks to Morgan. That was nice. Any other readers that want to submit weird stuff,
Yeah, yeah.
It always helps.
It is endless. Well, good. Unfortunately, that is all the time that we have for this week. We are going to keep our clothes on here on the Education Gadfly Show. But we'll be back next week. Don't forget to read us online, though, at www.edexcellence.net. Till then,
I'm Rick Hess.
And I'm Mike Petrilli of the Thomas B. Fordham Foundation, signing off.